21 on the bill, which talks about the, it starts from 20, talks about the appointment of the chief executive officer and the chief financial officer. We had a debate around it, and there was a view that probably we don't need to include the chief financial officer in the terms that are similar to the board. And we since made a proposal that probably we need to allow the chief financial officer to be a board member, but not be subjected to similar conditions as the rest of the board members, which means the 8 years, you know, requirement to be a board member would not apply to the chief financial officer. We then also look at the King's Court just to, you know, draw the attention of the members, or because some of the things that we're required to do is to look at the King's Court on what it says on matters like this. We did look at it, and it talks about the board having executive and non-executive members, and from the executive members, you need to have at least two of them, of which both the chief executive officer and the chief financial officer therefore becomes a member of the board, which means they become board members. And on that point, it means they are board members and they also participate on the day-to-day running of the entity. But what we have proposed that as much as they participate, the chief financial officer should not be bound to the terms and conditions associated with the board, which means he should be able to serve a bit longer. I'm just flagging it so that we remember where we ended and the issues that we have sort of discovered. And when we're reading the King's Report over the weekend or over the 2 days, we felt probably a member will have to look at that. I think if chief financial officer sitting as a board member, what it implies is that if he's not bound to that 8 years, he becomes or she becomes a permanent board member in one way or the other, if you were to look at it in that sense, because if he participated as a board member and he's not bound to the limit that we impose, then be she. So yeah, he or she. It doesn't get, you know, sort of restricted to in terms of time frame on how long you could sit in that board. In principle, it implies that you become a permanent board member. I just want to flag that. I'm going to leave the committee for discussion. But I want to go back slightly. There's another point, because we're sort of looking at these things just to make sure that we understand the rationale and the thinking behind this clause. I just want to go back, draw your attention to 18 as well, as a refresher. Section 18, which is the committee, the board committee or committees of the board. We said that we don't provide for concurrency. We are removing that. And then we are also removing the mentioning of participation by experts from outside. Therefore, meaning the board should be in a position to appoint those committees without concurrency by the minister. We then look at, because one of the things that we're told to do actually on the meeting before last is to look at the King's Report, of which we did. And if you look at the King's Report, I just want to quote those who might have the copy, so that they go to the correct sections in terms of that. The King's Report, it refers to, in particular, the Audit Committee. It says the Audit Committee must be appointed by the shareholders. It doesn't leave the appointment of the audit committee to a chairperson, to the board. In principle, actually, it even says members of the audit committee. It doesn't just talk about establishment, but it goes into details and say members of the audit committee must be appointed by the shareholders. Meaning that in this case, because the shareholder is government, whether represented through the Minister of Energy, she or he must have a say in the audit committee. The King's report doesn't necessarily talk to the other committees, but it singles out the audit committee in terms of its independence and in terms of reporting that the shareholder needs to appoint them. And also they report both to the shareholder and the board. I just want to flag those such as we discuss or as we come back to these points, we note that some of the things that were required for us to look at the King's report. So I felt I should just flag that. So what does that mean in terms of the audit report? It means in our provision in the bill, we don't allow the shareholder to have a say in the way we changed it. We don't allow the shareholder to have a say in the appointment of the audit committee, which is it might be contrary to what the King's report would say. Okay. Through you, Chair, I would like then to go back to where we ended, which is clause 39, if you allow it.
Fine, proceed.
On clause 39, let me start in clause 37. On clause 37, this is a minor amendment which relates to clause 37.1b, actually. Okay, I think it's 1c. We are taking out c there because there was a concern that actually, let me combine 37 and day 8 because these two sections are a bit related. When you read them, you need to read them together. There was a concern that the way the section is drafted, it implicates a person, you know, in case that person does not submit certain information as required by the administrator. Because the section, it deals with the appointment of the administrator by the minister for purpose of investigating ISMO, whether is it financial mismanagement, whether is it issues that the minister might not be comfortable with. Therefore, the minister has got the prerogative to appoint an administrator to do this investigation. Now, there was a concern that the way the section is drafted, it's not fair because it sort of criminalizes certain things on specific individuals. Therefore, there were changes there. The changes that we did to try to accommodate that is omit, as in page 17 from line 14, we omitted clause 31C. We omit that so that we try and comply with that. If then you go to page 18, line 11, it sort of refers back to that section in particular. Clause 18, line 11. We then substitute... Clause 18, line 11, we then substitute 11, which is B. But note that even though we're saying substitute, we are removing the last part of the sentence. It's page 18 from line 11, it's close 38 on the B. Yeah, sorry for that. It's on the B, it's close 38, 1B. Sorry for that confusion. Yeah, little 8 in the morning, I suppose. Yeah, on page 18, from line 11, we substitute 38.1b. Okay. Even though we're saying we're substituting, but in principle we are removing the last part of that sentence, which means if you were to read the sentence all the way up to, okay, let me just read the sentence, how it will read now. Fails to give data or information, okay, let me start from the first. A person commits an offense if he or she fails to give data or information or give false or misleading data or information when required to do so in terms of section 36. So the sentence is going to end there. We don't refer to when required by the administrator contemplated in section 37.4. It means we are sort of taking out that, because I think that was the concern, that we are sort of putting these things on the hands of a administrator to criminalize certain people. And then we move on. On the same page, page 18.
Hold on. Just hold on. Yeah.
In my subject, we are saying that's a technical. He says when a person fails to give data or information or gives false. And again, when we are saying we are taking away the administrator there, that means if the administrator is there, where is the administrator covered? If this, he wants information and this person says no, he's covered somewhere. Again, in that course, we have taken the last part, which refers to when required by the administrator. I'm saying if the person commits the same offense dealing with the administrator, that doesn't mean the administrator cannot deal with him using this law. Or is it covered somewhere when the administrator is taken over and somebody behaves the same way? Is the administrator covered to take that as an offense?
No, they are moving, huh?
Yes.
They are moving. They are moving. Okay, go first.
Thanks, Chair. I think that it covered in section 36. That's why it sort of refers to 36. Because if you look at 36, it's a high-level provision that allows the minister to establish an investigation for the affairs or the financial position of ISMO. I think that section is sort of, that's where the administrator sort of get commissioned. And that's just the process that then the administrator, I think section 37 sort of outlines how the administrator will go about, you know, or the minister will go about in doing that. I think the argument is that if you do it at that level, you would have in any event covered whatever that follows in section 37. That's how we sort of interpreted it.
I'm going to pretend as if I didn't read this. Just on that, what is interesting, see, 36.1, by the clock of page 17, says the minister may appoint a person to investigate the affairs or financial position of ISMO and compliance by ISMO with this act. I think that's where the terms of reference of the person would derive from. I'm triggered by what Ross is saying, because it just occurred to me that we need to clear that. Is that the only area where it's indicated what this person should be doing?
Thanks. I think Section 37, it goes into more details of what the administrator or the minister may direct the administrator to. Sort of specified 37.1, sort of specified, like, for instance, it says the minister may direct ISMO to take action specific by the minister if ISMO is financial difficulties or being mismanaged. But if you look at 37, I would agree with you, Chair, that it sort of empowers the minister to appoint the administrator. And then on 37, then you start teasing out the area that the minister could direct the administrator to in terms of the investigation. And then 3, it then says failing to comply with whatever that the minister might have directed the administrator in terms of section 1, therefore this would be a penalty that you'll be facing as a person or as ISMO, you know.
Okay. Just where you are. Oh, let me welcome DTE. River to D. Okay. Advocate Vanara, you wanted to say something as well? So, okay, you follow.
We're going to chair and to the honorable members. I think the question that the Prof raises is a legitimate question. Because if you look at Section 36, Section 36 empowers the minister to appoint an administrator. 37 deals with instances where the minister could intervene. And 38 deals with offences. Now, if the minister appoints the administrator, and the administrator is given specific functions to investigate, conduct investigation amongst other issues that he can do, he or she can do, and there's resistance, this is what the Honorable Prof is asking, there is resistance or there's a blatant refusal to cooperate with the administrator in providing this critical information that is required by the administrator. Is there something in this law, in this bill that we could build, that the administrator can rely on as a remedy to get this information? And I'm not persuaded by the argument that 36 then will come to the rescue of the administrator. I think what will then come to the rescue of the administrator is precisely what we're trying to delete. So that will be what will criminalize the conduct of those who are refusing or failing to cooperate with the administrator. That is my submission, Chair. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair, and I apologize for being late. I just wanted to agree with Advocate there. I don't agree with the deletion of that section, or that part of the section, where the deletion where the administrator is, where previously he was required to seek certain information. Because if you look at 37.4, the administrator is empowered in broad terms. And it is not very clear what other mechanisms he will employ in order to execute his functions. There's a concern there. I think we must be careful not to leave a lacuna in the act.
So, say another advocate. Before you respond, the Remlock wanted to make an input.
But 38.1b, I think it's in order when you conciliate the administrator. The challenge I think one has, maybe due to not following some of the discussion, the challenge at one hand was C, not B. For me, B was in order. was to give misleading information to the administrator, I think should be an offense. But my problem was with C because C was too wide, it was too broad. Because he fails to comply with the directive issued under section 37.4C. And if you check 34.7C, it says that if the minister appoints an administrator in terms of subsection 3, you go to C, and him, yeah, I think it's for C. Yeah, you see, first to comply with the directive issued under section 37.4C. And 4C was to say, an employee or a contractor of ECM must comply with the directive given by the administration. Look, I don't have a firm position on this one. My concern was that when I raised it here, it was just too broad. If the administrator, I'll give you an example, if the administrator say, can you switch that guy off? He's not coming on stream. And I say, no, there's no reason why you should choose him as an official. That person is coming on stream because it's the stability of the system. I'm going ahead, I can't do what you're telling me. I'm bringing him on stream. So it's an offense because I've ignored the directive of the administrator. For me, that doesn't, I'll just raise practical issues. And the administrator says, no, you have to bring, second example, you have to bring that station from Eskom on stream. You want it on stream. I say, no. But in terms of dispatching rules, we are saying we want to take the least cost, the one with the lowest cost. That guy doesn't have the lowest cost. G has got the lowest cost. I'm bringing the one with the lowest cost. I'm not going to bring that one. So I'm ignoring the directives of the administrator. For me, that was just a concern. But if we feel that it doesn't matter, we should leave it to court. For the court to interpret whether the directives of the administrator were reasonable, I think it still be fine because the court will be the final. I will trade on this matter because I'll get straight my case. I couldn't take the instruction from Advocate Panara because as the administrator, because these instructions were very unreasonable. In terms of the dispatching rules, and according to the rules said I'll take the one with the lowest cost. Secondly, the administrator was asking me to switch off that power station. I couldn't because it was going to threaten the stability of the system. So maybe we could leave it there and say the cost must decide on whether the directives of the administrator were reasonable. Because I think, and I understand that the government, the department was finding something that to go and try to list all the possible directives from the administrator, you would have a thing. So maybe it's better to leave it to a court and say the court will be the best arbitrator on whether the directives were reasonable or not.
Failing.
Yeah. Thanks, Chair. I mean, I'm just wondering, I mean, essentially what we got here then is a situation where if it's put under administration, the normal kind of rules of employment don't seem to then apply. Because essentially, if somebody doesn't obey a directive in a normal situation, that person could be disciplined and they could be fired. But what we're saying in this situation is that if an administrator comes in, not only will that person be fired, but they can also be liable to a criminal charge and have to go to jail or have to pay a fine. I'm just wondering, why is it that we want to have more stringent situation when an administrator is there that moves it over to the criminal side? I'm just wondering what the impetus is behind that. I can understand that an administrator might struggle to get discipline. A new person comes in, I can understand that there might be a hostility on the part of the staff or whatever, and so they're not going directives. But does it mean that we have to push it into the criminal arena, or can it not be dealt with in terms of normal staff kind of discipline? And I'm just interested in that.
An interesting point, but I'm sure Prof would say.
Would it not be safer then to just take a reasonable just before giving the second form? So it covers that it is admissible ever, it's not eternal. I think that section 4C is that if an employee or a contractor of ISMO must comply with a reasonable directive given by the state. So it's not expected that anything that is said must happen. It must be a reasonable subject. and keep that one that's administrated and in that second part. I'm making that proposal. I can just see that it, isn't it? On that 38G, we don't delete the administrator.
Okay, just hold on one moment before you respond.
I'm not a legal fool here, but I think what Prof is saying makes a lot of sense. Because my concern is that once you grant under what conditions this is being issued and all the details, might be a lengthy thing. But because it has got some, and I agree with Honorable Kaili, because if you go to section 8, 2, and 3, I mean, this thing has got serious implications. The directive of serious implications, you get a fine, or you can go to jail for 5 years. If that offense is repeated, then you are going to jail. So it has many implications. So I have to assume the reasonable directives are fine, and you can give to the court. Let the court determine whether the directive was reasonable, and leave it to the court whether, you know, what you did warrants is fine or because B is fine, but to give misleading information on its own is an element of fraud, you know. So the normal you are sure that you are not bringing something new to the policy, and you this is a misrepresentation of fact, and then you should be charged for that. So I don't think it's a problem. Like if Honorable Kaye say, for instance, on B, you failed to give information to the administrator, required by the administrator. The administrator, like a normal, let's say CEO or whatever, had a right to charge for insubordination. And say, you were given this directive to do the following, which was reasonable, and you didn't comply, now you're charged. And the disciplinary hearing must commence, and then follow the normal process. I'm comfortable with the presentation of for the court.
Before I comment, I'll allow you to respond.
Thanks, sir. I'm glad the issues were sort of debated, because that, if you read the submission, I think that's the argument that people are making, that you don't have to criminalize these things, because there's a process in which you deal with people who don't comply. So that's why we thought of it proper that we take out that criminalization element in B, because if you take out that last part of that sentence, it sort of removes the criminalization aspect of not giving information to the administrator. And then I think C, that is 37C, I think we, through you, Chair, I think we can take that on board if members there are compatible.
Which one? 37.4C?
Yeah, adding the...
One of adding the 18, a reasonable directive.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, here in legal people must help us, what would be the implications of removing that part at this stage when required by the administration of 37.4? Does it have any implication if you remove that administrator? Because the suggestion that I'm trying to follow the discussion here, the submission from the department which fails to give data or information or give false or misleading data or information when required to do so. And somewhere else, but then that part of the administrator is removed. What would be the implication?
I'm not following you. Which part?
I didn't hear Mr. Madino quite well. I thought you said on 38.1b, that reference to the administrator being removed. So I'm trying to look, my question is, what are the implications of removing that part? So I was just saying, can the legal people guide us on this one?
In my understanding, the DPE and Advocate Van Aert, the same problems with that. Because it leaves the gap. Okay, guys, please don't grow up.
Thank you, Shaki. You see, but this is the reality of the situation. An administrator gets on board when things have gone wrong. Now, you are not dealing with an ideal situation. The moment you decide to bring an administrator, but you say this administrator, amongst other things, must conduct investigations. Now, there will never be a successful investigation if information is withheld. And if people are given or the space for people not to operate with the investigation, see, this provision creates an offense for failure to punish that administrator who's doing this critical function in an abnormal environment. There's something for something to rely on, because if you don't cooperate with me, I can lay a criminal charge. That is the essence of that provision. So if you take it out, then the administrator faced with resistance or non-cooperation or withholding of information, he does not have the remedy to assist him or help conduct that investigation successfully.
I'm not sure whether my point is to be made correctly. I don't have a problem with that. I would say, Mr. Maduna, the way he reads the sentence, it's ending somewhere else. Maybe if you read it again, because the reference to the administrator in that provision, I think Mr. Maduna is proposing that it be removed. So my question is, what are the implications? Maybe if you read the sentence again.
No, I agree. I think let's edit it in.
I'm saying you are hearing me that our initial proposal was to remove any reference to the administrator. Hence my question was, what are the implications of removing that reference to the administrator? That was my question.
I think when we're reading the comment was that if you add to that, it sort of implies that you can criminalize a particular person when you don't, you know, do it. But I think what explanation has come forth now is that probably we need to criminalize that person if it doesn't submit the information. So
this is what I wanted to understand. Albert Vanara, you took, you stole the thunder that dealing with this clause 37, in fact 36 and 37, is dealing with an abnormal situation. Because the same situation could have arrived under conventional and normal practice within an ISMO, an operating ISMO, where either the CEO or CFO could require that before issue. And then obviously, as Honorable Frailing said, then they can, there are some guides and procedures that guide them to take up some action on people who do not provide that information. But when an administrator comes in, by implication, it means we're in an abnormal environment, because the minister was compelled to take up that drastic action. Now, I mean, without elaborating, it is understandable the staff now in ISMO would understand that there's something abnormal. The administrator is going around asking for information, doing certain things in order to bring back things to equilibrium. Now, if someone conducts himself for herself under that situation, really, you know, my assumption is that warrants some tough action now. Because everyone is expected to contribute towards restabilization of the of his mom. I was assuming in my penis. Now, can we summarize once again then, what do you consider to be bank? Of course, at the end of the day, we'll have to be convinced. We've said a lot of things. Initially, you said that 7.1c should be omitted. You still find it should be omitted. Because we've also retracted certain areas. And we are retracting 7.1c 37.1.6 in conjunction with the last part of 38.1b, if I understood you correctly. Oh, before you respond, Advocate Nigiso.
Thank you, Chair. There's a part about also the capture, because according to my notes, the only amendment in 38 is to qualify the directive of the administrator. That is only it.
Okay, qualify the directive of the administrator, as in 38.1b. Hmm? Oh, sorry. That's 7.4b. Yes, sir.
I think the point that we are dealing with is that under 37.4c, you want to insert the proposal of Honorable Mari to that. That's the qualification they're talking about. That should comply with a reasonable directive. So just to qualify on the directive, that should be a reasonable directive.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, fine. Okay, Cody.
Thanks, sir. We would amend accordingly.
On page 17, I find the list. There was only one proposal. Can I make my own proposal on page 17? We said we are moving on page 17, we're not eating at all. Is this not the right time for me to make my comments on page 17?
Okay.
On page 17, say, if I go to 37.7, they were saying not to explain the subsection 3 above. The minister may dissolve the board if the minister on good cause soon loses confidence in the ability of the board before. If you go to section 37.1, we are putting in there, let's go to 3, we are putting an administrator there with no reference to the board being dissolved, which means, according to the first part of section 7, there is something wrong with the ISMO, nothing wrong with the board, and you put it at an administrator, and you, after doing that, you go on and saying, when this is happening, the board will not be operative. And thereafter you go down, you because you have something prepared, you dissolve the board and put an administrator. I'm trying to work out now this scenario. How is it possible for there to be something wrong with the ISMO such that you put in an administrator when there's nothing wrong with the board? And when that administrator is there, you go a step further, you say the board may not, I'm reading now 4B. In 4B you are saying the board may not, while the administrator is responsible for the relevant function, exercise any of the powers. So the board is still there, but it's not using any power, and the administrator is operating. And let's assume that the administrator can be operating for 3 months or 6 months, but the board is not dissolved. The next part, things are so serious that you dissolve the board and put it in favor. I'm trying to question the relevance of the first section, where you are going to have an administrator with the board that is doing nothing. Why don't you have only the second part, where when there is something wrong, so wrong that you bring in the administrator? Not only do you think it's a straight act, you invoke 7 and dissolve the board. Under what circumstances would there be a possibility for the board, according to section 4B, to be there doing nothing while the administrator is administrating? And secondly, the second scenario, when things are so bad, not only do you call the administrator, you dissolve the board.
Honourable Mulato and then Honourable Khairi.
Yeah, I think that the point of Honourable Khairi, Commissioner, not Honourable Khairi, Honourable Mulato makes sense. Because if the board, if there's an administration, there's something that there's no board, the board has been dissolved. So the question is, why do we insist on keeping B? Because if you remove B, it provides clarity in the mind of everybody and even the court. Say, the logical steps that are followed here is that the minister dissolves the board in terms of 7B, and then the minister is appointed to the administrator. So there's no board. So you wouldn't have to refer to B if B is taken out. But the assumption and understanding from everyone is that there's no board. But if you put B, I think then it brings a bit of confusion. It's like you have got a situation of a suspended board. You know, in a way, the board has been told that you are on, put aside, you are on a special leave that Mr. Jam has run with the functions of ISMO. You're still there. You're still there. We decide maybe after the administrator uncovers further things that are wrong, then I'm going to come to that position to dissolve it finally. But if B is removed, then in the mind of everybody, seven, the sequence of things that the minister is dissolving the board and putting in that instrument.
Honourable Freddy.
Thanks, Chair. I mean, I would imagine that B is possibly in there, that you could have a situation, and I think we all need to kind of bear in mind the importance of ISMA as well in terms of keeping the lights on in the country. So this isn't just a normal state-owned entity where, you know, if it's run into the ground, you know, then it affects that. I mean, this affects the whole electricity grid. So, and the reason why I'm saying this is that you could have a situation where ISMA, for instance, runs into financial difficulty, but the actual operations of ISMA in terms of keeping the lights on are still operating and that part is still fine. So I would imagine that this B part is saying that if a certain part requires an administrator to come in and deal with the finances of ISMA, for instance, but at the same time, we feel that the board can still be responsible for the operation of the actual clip. I mean, that's what I imagine is probably in B in this particular instance. But, you know, I'm not averse to taking it out, but I would imagine that that was what the drafters had in mind. I'm just interested to hear.
Honourable Khateva, Honourable Mulato.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I think Honourable Vanara would agree with me. Normally, when you dissolve, when you want to put an administrator, you must dissolve the board first. You can't have two people operating at the same time. You can't have an administrator decide and a board decide. You have conflicting power. I would have expected probably that the arrangement there of the intervention of the minister, that once probably he has given the board, because the other thing that also comes there is that when the minister has given his more enough opportunity to present itself, with the reason we put out probably to explain itself in terms of its operation, once the minister sees that they can't operate and it dissolves the board, then put in the administrator. So I think if they can be that probably part of arrangements, because you can't put an administrator with the board today. And also it will have also cost implication in both sides. There.
Honourable
Rafa. I agree with the Honourable Rafa. You can't have an administrator and have a board. It's not the two wouldn't coincide. Because I think we shouldn't confuse it with a situation where, for instance, of provinces where people are said the administrator has moved in, but we still have an MEC. So we let's not confuse that. Here's a company. Here's a company. If you say you're bringing the administrator, then the board must be out. Because there, in terms of the 74A, it says if the minister appoints an administrator in terms of subsection 3, the administrator may do anything which ISMO might otherwise be empowered and required to do by or under this to the exclusion of whatever. I don't know what this exclusion of ISMO is. But so the assumption is that you have no confidence in the board. You can't bring a partial administrator who has partial. So you want an administrator to take full charge of the of or the affairs of the company. You're putting that under administration. It means no other person is responsible to exercise any authority on the except the administration. If we bring two people, we're going to bring a bit of conflict. Because certain people say no, but we also take instruction from, or some say we're taking instruction from the administrator. You want the administrator to take responsibility. Because think of, when you appoint the administrator, things are so bad that you don't have confidence in the body. Otherwise, I don't know, maybe there are examples that I don't know of. You know, where you bring the board and bring the administrator and you have a board that's not, and then like one of my tutors said, and that should can be in that situation of having a board. I don't know why you want to retain the board when you're not allowed to be there.
Yes. Can I make sure that before that we get one hour? It's around as well, Ariko.
Okay, sir.
To me, I've gone through this and I had a lot of questions as well. I think before applying or express myself, it would be a question, particularly on 37, 4A. When you say the administrator may do anything to the exclusion of ISMO, isn't that equivalent to the action in 57.7b, the dissolution of the board? It's just a provocative question, you know, because you're saying administrator do anything to the exclusion of ISMO, which means to the exclusion of the board, which is the highest authority in ISMO. I'm provoking it so that I get clarified. Because if you look at 37.7 as a whole, the administrator runs things at board level until a board is replaced within 3 months. So, basically, I actually want to go when you say exclusion of ISMO. Am I correct when I say that the exclusion of the board? Of course, the assumption is that the status of the CEO and CFO were part of the board are still part of management, so they still conduct themselves as management, not as a board. So I wanted just to be provocative on that, as we will be responding to also the inputs that have been done. I think as we move along as well, I wanted to check is, am I understanding correctly that the 37, although had it as intervention by minister, also contains substantial provisions for placing ISMO under administration? Fine. But I just want to say, it doesn't seem to me the terms of administration have been either well articulated or properly structured. From what I listen, I just wanted to keep that at the back of your mind as well. I'll keep on coming back to my terminology. The terms of placing is more under administration. Okay, I see the legal minds are itching in this corner. Okay, whichever you want to go first.
I can go first, Chair. Okay, I agree with you there that when the first clause, what 37.4a, went there to exclusion of ISMO, I think it's couched in a way that ISMO does not exist. You know, the board has been sort of dissolved. I think you are saying it correctly. But I just want to be mindful of the administrative steps that need to be taken when a situation like this arises. Where, for example, when you take the company under judicial management, you just don't dissolve a board willy-nilly like that. There are certain steps that need to be taken. Here, my understanding also is that you don't just go straight into dissolving the board and you appoint the administrator. You put them probably not under suspension, but you freeze their functions so that in the meantime, the administrator will be performing certain functions that would ordinarily be performed by the board while certain investigations are taking place. Yet, later in the process, the board will be dissolved. That is why, my understanding is that after having given this 37B1, after having given the board a reasonable opportunity to be heard, my understanding is that there will have been certain investigations or whatever that will be taking place. But then, if minister is certified that the board needs to be dissolved, then it will be dissolved. Thank you.
I also agree that this trust and service is part of the administrative steps that must be followed, because otherwise the board will just take the minister to court, because resolution is final, resolution is not abstention, resolution is complete. If you say dissolve a board, you dissolve it to reconstitute newly. Let's say now the minister dissolves the board after finding that there are financial difficulties in the ISMO. Then the administrator is appointed and finds that now it's not a fault of the board, nothing is wrong. So now is the minister going to go through the process of appointing the board all over again, reconstructing the board? So that's not part of the administrative steps that are required. There are legislation that are involved here. Then part of the minister is guided by many administrative legal instruments here. So it doesn't make sense to say the resolution will be the first and then the administrator. And secondly, the minister is involved in two phases in 37. Firstly, to investigate, because the minister is identifying a problem with ISMO, calls in the administrator to investigate, which means the minister does not even have full information to dissolve the board at that stage. That is why the administrator is involved. Yes. And this stage of first phase of involving the administrator that will not necessarily always lead to the dissolution of the board, because the administrator compiles the board. They may find that this is due to no fault of the board. So therefore, it cannot work. Then there's a second phase where the board is dissolved. Then the administrator is there now, which is part, I think, what is Honor Project was referring to, where the administrator now is running ISMO and the no board. We have catered for that too, because then after the board is dissolved, there is the minister can appoint an administrator in that. But the first phase of administrator is to give more information to the minister, to take an informed decision.
Sure. Let me just check this with relationship number 7-3. But because my understanding that before the minister will go and intervene, will put an officer to put an investigation and bring the investigation back, then after that will he also give the board an opportunity to respond to those particular allegations or to those particular challenges that emerge within the ISMO. Then ISMO will, the minister, it says on 3, the minister will give this ISMO enough time to respond to these things. Enough a reasonable opportunity. After this given reasonable opportunity, they're going to respond, and if the minister sees fit that they didn't comply and do whatever, then you appoint an administrator.
Honorable Khadebe, I haven't seen a reference to assessor here.
Yeah.
So I think your point is rather tricky in that way, because an assessor can, or an investigator can do that whilst the board is functioning. But it's by no means included here. This whole thing goes right into the introduction of an administrator and freezing of the board. I don't know why people don't want to say suspend. Maybe I'm going to be provocative. Just say, look, it's actually suspending. But when you suspend, you don't throw any person or a structure out. You're just freezing its activity once it exists. And then the other step is dissolve. Now, all of members are challenging that thing. Department of Energy, sponsor of this bill, there is an argument that we are not convinced that you should suspend the board, or you should have a two-stage approach. That is, introduce administration, appoint an administrator, and step one, suspend the board, and then step two, if it goes to that level, it is off the board. If I read what members are saying. So I think at some stage a lot of things have been said, we need to see what the patent is. Now there are a lot of hands flying up there. One of the members, do you mind if Advocate Vanara would have his say before you make input? Kulwa? Advocate Vanara, the author would like to say something before.
I'm looking at section 37.1. If you look at 7.1, it says the minister may direct is going to take any action specified by the minister if HISMO is a financial card or is being mismanaged. That means we are there already. That's what we have noticed. And once it is mismanaged, that means to me the board has failed. It has failed to perform its function effectively and efficiently. And that's what is the governance the board is supposed to have been doing. And has failed to comply with any law or any policy and message in the Act. Once the board is there and all these things happen, because to me it means the board has failed. That's why the board is going to be given a chance to defend itself even before you call the administrator. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it's not that you are still calling the administrator because you do not know what's happening. You are calling the government because the governance of this structure by its board has failed. That is what the first part is saying. But I'm saying, once you know that the board has failed and you call the administrator, surely you must go straight to section 7A and do that. Otherwise, don't call the administrator. Once you call it, the governance, the board has failed. If the board has failed, it defends itself first. As why did A1, A, B, and D in section 7A happen? And if it is able to defend itself, you don't call the administrator. But once it fails to defend itself, it's then that you dissolve it, and then you call the administrator.
He's still thinking. Okay, wonderful, Mlod.
One, I think that we need to clarify one issue. The board are not employees of this. The board are not covered by the relations act of Kenya. You have a right as a shareholder to recall the board without giving an explanation. Because I accept now, maybe I have to keep quiet around the provisions of section 14.2, where you start to indicate other what conditions with the minister report. I was very uncomfortable about it. I said maybe people know other things that I do know, that ministers do funny things in terms of calling people from board and all that. But as a shareholder, you don't need to read why you want to call somebody. These are not employees. You don't have to come up with qualifications and say under this circumstance or under this circumstance. As we avoided it in 14.2. I think that, I don't know how to tell you that. If we want to recall you as a shareholder, I've lost confidence in you, I don't have to give you a reason. I'm just saying that person must be out of that board. I have a right of recall. So I just wanted to pass that, because there's a point where the people said, if you dissolve the board, the minister can be taken to court. These are not employees. If I appointed you, I have the right to recall you.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just going to clarify that. If I have no confidence, well, I can wait for the AGM. If I feel maybe there will be problems of people raising issues that why did you. But the AGM, I remove all of them. I don't owe any present an explanation. And the AGM has the right of the shareholder. The shareholder doesn't have to give anything why I'm removing. At AGM, I'm no longer confirming. Advocate for Vanara to continue the board. You must be there 1 year, but at the end of the AGM, I've got to say, I am no longer sending that person, and I'm sending you to the person.
Fine.
Okay, Chairperson, last point, and this is where I want Advocate Vanara to come in. As things are mentioned in the legislation, and things look And the argument of Honorable Khayyam then holds what? To say you can bring the administrator to look at certain areas of East Mono, the whole area. Because if you read, and I'm just bringing issues here on the table so that we can look at this in completion. 3B says, Hismo fails to comply with the directive contemplated in subsection 1 within the stated field of the minister may be, after having afforded Hismo a hearing on any submission received, replace the member in the same manner as the departing members have been appointed, or where circumstances require, appoint a person as an administrator to take over the relevant function of Hismo. So I don't know whether the relevant function is talking about the whole functions of Hismo or just the specific function of Hismo. That has to be clarified. The other issue here, maybe I'm losing it a bit, it's the minister, it's very clear under what circumstances the minister would be dissolving this. Because they are stated in 37.1. The minister is saying, 37.1A, ISMO is financially mismanaged with financial difficulties. B, it fails to perform its functions. D, fails to comply with any law or policy vested in this act. And the issue has been given a reasonable time frame. Within the reasonable time, they've been given an opportunity to respond, and the minister has decided that I'm not happy with your response, and therefore I'm going to take action and dissolve this one. But I don't know. I would have to advocate rather as was in the corporate law field, to just give us an understanding of whether this thing is common, where you have an administrator in put in a situation and then having a board. You know, I don't know what happened, for instance, in the Sambo case, whether when the administrator was appointed in Sambo, the board was still in existence. But I know for a fact that in pension fund you can't have a board in the administrator. That's not possible. When once you lose a confidence in the chances you remove them, you don't have both. You only have one. Maybe because this is a company, different rules apply. But in pension fund I can say that once the registrar of pension fund say I have no confidence in that board, I'm removing that board and I'm bringing that minister, the two don't coexist.
Thank you, Chair. Again, using the same 37.3. In 37.3, it is stated, if ISMO fails in complying with the directive, I don't know when you say ISMO or qualify to that. Because I cannot refer to ISMO without referring to the board. To me, therefore, even that, it is showing that it is the board of ISMO that is failing. It has given all the necessary time to respond. Therefore, it is that board that needs to be dissolved. Nothing else.
Because it's only here from the land and so who's of this stuff. I just want to provoke you. Am I understanding you, Mr. Spam, correctly if you say there are existing legal instruments and legal guidelines for placing an entity like this law under administration? They exist elsewhere, and that they can be applicable here as well. You said FASA. For example.
Yes.
Is this an existing practice?
Chair, because there's a minister involved here, this is public administration, the minister is guided by those legal instruments. It's not like the private sector or anything else. Now, we're talking about a state-owned entity, and this, whatever action the minister takes here is constituting an administrative action. So there are steps, the minister is bound to follow those steps.
If you look at them, what is PAJ? Just to put us in a better perspective.
It's the promotion of administrative justice and which
okay.
governs the actions of the ministers in situation in public administration.
Okay. And even in situations like this.
Yes, sir.
Remember, honorable members, I said, my understanding over and above saying intervention by minister is actually placing ISMO under administration. And I'm keen to be that we have a clear understanding. What are the terms of putting ISMO under administration. I'm sure I'm wrong, this is what I'm trying to grapple with. So that they appear and we are able to recrystallize those, because this is a very sensitive area. It must be well restructured. Yes, ma'am.
Chair, just to maybe add to what CCM said, under PAJA, I think because, like she said, that because minister would be taking an administrative action of recalling the board, okay, there's nothing that prevents the minister to probably give notice to the board, a reasonable notice, probably 14 days before the AGM, or 14 days before he recalls them. So all what she's referring that they must be given reason why they are being recalled, or maybe not necessarily given reason, but he must.
No, no, talk on to the DT.
Oh, okay.
Because they're probably something.
Yeah.
Okay, see, but let's give him a chance.
Yeah, but Chairperson, before you give him a chance, I think we need to be very clear. Are we dealing with the government department or are we dealing with the company? Let's be clear. But what, if the minister, in what role is he acting here?
I
want to be clear, because we keep on coming to Bali. And the minister is acting in her capacity, or his capacity, I assume. We're dealing with the company here, we're dealing with the shareholder.
Yeah.
So, are we saying the rights of a shareholder are being suspended by what is contained in the budget? I think people who think that must help us here, because the shareholders' rights are very clear in terms of the Companies Act. The Companies Act, I'm appointing you there as an employee.
Okay.
My violation doesn't apply. They're writing an AGM to remove all of it without giving an explanation. So once you start to say, when the minister does the removal of board, not compelling people to sit again on the board, is an administrative action. I need to be that right.
No, that's good. Remember my question was, Honorable Lord, was that tell us the legal instruments and legal guidelines in placing something like ISMO, a state-owned entity, under administration. Okay. Okay, it's good. No, okay, I know another. Because I want us to see, because you see, what Honorable Lord is raising is that, to me, as PAJA and also as the Companies Act, which prevails over it. Of course, you have to bear in mind who to prof now, yeah, and the Honorable Khadija, yeah, of course, they have, you know, other experience, you know, the university suspension or administrator, you know, experience, which we all know from time to time. Okay, I mean, before singing a cool advocate for now.
Thank you, Chair. So we need to remember that we are dealing with public administration and corporate law, all roles in one here, because we're dealing with a state-owned entity. And this is no ordinary shareholder. It's not like an ordinary shareholder. This is the minister. The minister is a shareholder on behalf of the state here. So think this is bound to be broader than the private corporate shareholding.
Okay. We are here, eh? Hi. Advocate Navara Banara. The floor is yours, Nkulambu Tarupar.
No, thanks, thanks, Chair. Look, I think what is to be, I think members would recall that ESCOM, during the public hearings, made a passionate plea that this bill touches on provisions that should ordinarily be left to the regulators in the existing Companies Act, and that we should not in this bill try to rehash issues that are sufficiently dealt with there. And they raised that sharply because they were having concerns that once we start embarking on that exercise, we might start in this bill do things that are inconsistent with how things are done in the Companies Act. Now, what you see with these types of challenges that are now currently before the committee, one is reminded by those wise words, reminded of those wise words. You see, the reality here is that we're creating what one would say is a sui generis, a specific type of a company. It's a state-owned company. and that the minister is the sheriff, because this is 100% state owned. So the minister will be acting as the sheriff. The bill itself does give to a certain extent the right of people to be heard, which is enshrined in the Constitution, because the Constitution gives you a right to be heard before an adverse decision is taken against you. The PAJA gives effect to a right that has been confirmed already in the Constitution. And the Companies Act is not supreme to the Constitution. But having said that, it is correct to say if the shareholders, in terms of the Companies Act, if the shareholders have lost confidence in the board members, that is sufficient for them to be recalled. That is the reality. It is like in a court of law. If I have lost confidence in the presiding officer, whether it's for reasons perceived or real, fact of the matter, I have no confidence in the person that is supposed to determine my fate. The honorable thing is for that presiding officer to recuse him or so. Now, this is the same principle that is applicable in companies. And that spirit is kept in this bill, because before people are removed, they are given an opportunity to address the minister. Now I want to come back to this clause 37. Clause 37 deals with two issues that the Prof correctly highlighted. But I think the issue here is more of a policy easy to be decided by the committee. If you look from clause 1, 2, and 3, 1, 2, and 3 deals with one issue. Then 7 deals with another. But they both somewhere involve the involvement of an administrator. Clause 1, 37.1, says the minister may direct ISMO to take any action specified by the minister if ISMO is in financial difficulty or is being mismanaged, fails to perform its functions effectively or efficiently, or has acted unfairly or in a discriminatory manner, inequitable way towards a person to whom it owes a duty under this Act, or has failed to comply with any law or any policy envisaged in this Act. Now, paragraphs A to D tells you instances where the minister may issue directives. Now, what then paragraph section 2 deals with how those or what the directive must contain. It must state the reason for issuing the directive. It must state the steps which must be taken to remedy the situation that has caused financial difficulty or mismanagement, that has caused failure to perform efficiently or effectively, or that has caused the ISMO board to act unfairly or in a discriminatory manner. That directive must give a reasonable period within which such steps must be taken. Now this is one action. It flows from a directive that has been given. It's given when this has happened, and that directive must contain these three issues. If you then get to 3, then 3 says, once that has happened, the minister has identified certain deficiencies, he's given directives. Once he's given directives, he said when these must be performed, and the board fails to comply with the directives within the stated period, then these are the remedies available to the minister. Now you're dealing with a board that is not cooperating with the minister. The minister must give them an opportunity, must hear why are they not complying with his directive. B, after having afforded ISMO a hearing, this is what the minister can do. can replace the members in the same manner departing members have been appointed. Or, where circumstances so require, he can appoint a person as an administrator to take over the relevant function of ISMO. Now, there was a question of what is meant by a relevant function. Now, what is not clear from this function, I mean from this provision? My interpretation is that it is not envisaged that the entire board is taken out. Now, this is what Honorable Maya Tula correctly raised, because it presents a difficulty. Because you are bringing in an administrator and there is a board that in place. Remember, there are two things that can happen. You said it may replace the members or appoint a person as administrator. Now, once you leave the board, you go to opt an administrator in the presence of the board. Already you're creating this predicament, complained of by the members, to say, how do you have two bulls in one roll? Now that is a policy decision that the committee must now decide on. In your view, would that be an ideal situation? That is a question I think that I leave to the members to respond. Now, if you go to 4, it says, remember the minister has had two options when the board has failed to comply with the directive that he or she has issued. It's either to replace those members or to appoint the administrator in their presence. Now, if he or she appoints the administrator in the board's presence, this is what is going to happen, and this is the point again raised. And that's why you have to have that provision that says the administrator performs his or her duties to the exclusion of the board, because the board is still in place. Now, whether that is an ideal situation or not, I leave it to the members to decide. Of course, now we included that the employee must comply with the reasonable directives that are given by the administrator. That is one way of bringing an administrator into the scene. Now, the second aspect of bringing an administrator to the scene is in subsection 7. Now, subsection says, notwithstanding subsection 3. That in itself says, forget about what is said in subsection 3. The minister may dissolve the board on good cause shown. If on good cause shown, he has lost the confidence in the ability. In other words, there it is clear that the board will be history and that the only person that will be there will be the administrator. And the question, as I already said, that members must preoccupy themselves with is whether this the scenario in subsection 3 is an ideal situation. Thank you, sir.
From Rafa, can we allow the some response from the other advisors or experts so that we can come in? Just so.
I think the more there are deliberations in this section, the more confusion. Not confusion. I get clarity as how I advocate there, and it makes perfect sense. But as I'm reading the section, it's causing more, and the section is in itself, the way it's worded, cause more and more confusion, such that I'm really close to saying or to proposing that probably Joey go back and read up this section. But I just want to also point the conflicting clauses there. If we look at clause 37, 4B, which says the board may not, while administrator is responsible for the relevant function, exercise any of these powers, function, and duties relating to the country. but for me it contradicts with 37.5a, which says the minister may review the performance of the board. We have agreed that it's more against the board regularly. So how does the minister, while it is under administration, so how does the performance of the board, which has been, whose function has been set aside, be reviewed regularly? So it's also sort of a confusion as well. Okay.
My understanding, so to throw it to the staff, correct me once again, of the broad thrust of this section is that it actually the three stages. The first one, as articulated by 37.1 and 2, is that the minister, after having observed and fixed the thing, maybe a local budget, that assess that thing, it may not be fully expressed yet. If then the minister then calls for, gives the directive for what I am now, initial remedial action to be done by the board. That's step one. Moment and clause. Right. Then the second one, that is 3 and 4 to quite an extent, is, although not articulated here, is the suspension of the board. Still exists as it's there, but then it's taken over by the administrator. But it doesn't take away the confusion of now taking certain members there, leaving them there, and taking certain functions, because that's a little bit confusing, because to me, suspension means suspension. We get an administrator to just take over and decide on things, because the main thing of introducing an administrator is just to fix up things. Because God, under what I call the state one, has failed, or whatever. The other stage now, which is starting in 7, is outright dissolution. I'm looking even at the department on this. I'm not saying that's right, but it's just for me to try and understand what this clause is trying to articulate. Fine. Or not.
Sir President, as you want to go back to the issue that has been presented by Advocate Panada before us, that the issue of whether you want the board and the administrator to be coexist is a policy matter that we need to decide. And I think we need to confront that issue and deal with it. Personally, I would submit that you want to dissolve the board and put the administrator. You don't want the two to coexist. Because there's no other that is been given to us legal, why you want them to coexist. So I would admit that you want to dissolve the board and put in administrator. That would be my humble submission. But well, the other issue I would want to have the DPE and the state law advisor to have a discussion with me outside. On the application of Paja in relation to the minister and the shareholder. Because when I read, I was reading Paja was saying it refers to an organ of the state. Mm. Now go back to the constitution, because the state has defined, one of the states is defined under 239 of the constitution. Mm. And under that, there's no public entity. There's no SOE. Mm. So I'm just saying, that's a debate I would want to have outside, because it's not convincing. And because what's been defined as an organ of state excludes a state-owned terminology. I'm better than reading this thing wrong. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not quite familiar with the laws of interpretation. But that's what's stated at the constitution. It's not a debate that I want to pursue now. Outside of teaching, when you have teaching.
Yeah, but if you look at where it's able to come to that, in page, I think, 18 or 19,
yeah.
It's something around organ of state. So we won't have the liberty of discussing it during tea. It has to come in. Because we're all interested in it. Not finished first in any
case. I think the critical issue without digressing, I think the critical issue before us, does the committee want the administrator to coexist with the board? That's the issue before us. I submit that we don't want to have that situation. You've lost confidence in the board, you dissolve the board, put the administrator, and where they say it claims to be a confusion around, I'll go to it, around 5A, that the review of the pronouns is a regular valid administration. Here is a valid clause because we want to see the progress that the administrator has made in relation to addressing the very reasons that you dissolve the board under, which is under the 7.1A, the 7.1, which is ABC. So you say the board is a foundation because those are they are giving it clear why you are dissolving ISMO, except when you want to factor in the point that has been raised by Advocate Bala on good cause show, you know, which is another criteria. But the provisions are very clear about the 7.1, why you want to dissolve the board. The board is another foundation because the board has become a community function, effective or efficient. The board has failed to comply with any law or policy basis in this act. For instance, I'm not sure whether we're going to retain C. I think C has been moved. I'm not sure. People have to talk about it. I think it's been moved. So, it's under those three circumstances, and you have given ISMO a reasonable time to state the major issues and state the reason for issuing the directive and the steps that must be taken. You are saying to ISMO, as the minister, I want you, because of the challenge here, I want you to do the following, to be taken to remedy the situation, and you're given info that I have to be heard, whatever, and you're still not satisfied that they have addressed this issue under 7.1, and you want to dissolve ISMO. I think the 5A is very clear to me. When the administrator is put in place, you have to see the progress of the administrator. Has the administrator resolved the underlying risk for the dissolution of ISMO? If after 6 months, or within 6 months, the administrator has to resolve the issue, you want to say, thank you, administrator, may you leave, and I'm going to appoint a new board. So that's the way I'm understanding it. So I'm saying the issue, Chairman, which we need to focus on right now, that policy issue. You want the administrator and board to coexist, must have changed that. Resolve the board, then the administrator.
Rob.
Thank you, sir. I think I'm endorsing that. I think one of the issues is first in subsection 3B. Where in 3B they are saying, have they afforded ISMO a hearing on any submission received, says replace the member in the same manner as department as the party members have been appointed. Where they say or, I'll say and, don't say either or. Once you dismiss, you also set up the same. And to emphasize the same point, that's why on 7.4a, they're also saying at the exclusion of ISMO. We're not saying anything new here. We're just emphasizing what is said in the video. So I'm proposing that let's endorse the policy matter, that it do take out the board when looking at the suit.
I think, honorable members, we agree. Actually, we want the same thing. We endorse that we second the issue of that loss or that policy matter. But the other issue that I want to raise here, that problem regards that the department must be able to clarify the time period of the administrator. How many months is the administrator going to be in existence? If that can be able to be clarified. Second one, the issue of 7.3a, where it speaks of the reasonable opportunity that the minister is giving. What is the reasonable opportunity? Imagine an open end. The minister must give his more. What is the time period? 3 months, a month, a week, how many days? Does the minister give his more to respond to it? Because once you don't effect a specific time period, you will have a problem whereby this thing, you know, it gets open-ended. Yes.
It would be appropriate on the fact that we decide that, because these decide now who are really doing surgical work, who are restructuring and molding the section. Mr. Ferguson.
Thank you, Chair. Much for the other members. I just want to endorse that policy position as well. And I think listening, and initially I was quite confused as how it was written and how it was being put across. And I really want to just encourage us to look at the suggestion from the advocate, from the, I think it's on the state enterprise, as to rewrite the section. Because when you read it, the more you're reading it, the more you're reading into it, the more we pull clauses out of it, the more it's not fitting in. And I think if we rewrite it, given that the committee, the members have endorsed, most of the members have endorsed the policy position, if we start just rewriting it, it flows better, that we understand better. Because I have to say, I've been reading it backwards and forwards. Every time, and you go back to the top, you go to 37.1, and you come back to 37.7, and you go, and every time you flip top, you get a different interpretation. So I'm just appealing to us, please, to do that. Thank you.
One of the reasons that it's clear that there's a very good thing. Well, members, remember, I said my understanding, this seems to us be articulating three things. One, initial remedial action by the board. Two, suspension of the board, though it's not meeting that deal. And three is dissolution of the board. Now, DOE, department, you hear what the members are saying. Not that I'm pondering what changes their position, but if you have anything to say. Well, the essence of the argument now, that why do you have to go through the suspension route if the initial remedial action has been done by the board and the minister was not convinced? You know, this is what members are saying. I'm looking at it, I'm articulating it strategically, because it therefore means that after giving a directive and the initial remedial action is not satisfying the minister, then the minister should simply move to the last stage of just dissolving the board. Because the minister would argue that sufficient ability, you know, space and opportunity has been given to the board to fix that thing. Over to you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Chair. I think we would do as agreed. We would amend the section accordingly and see, I mean, we'll have to talk with our advisors and see how we would reword the section so that it's much clearer and while taking into account some of the inputs made in terms of making sure that when we introduce the administrator, the board should have been dissolved by then. I think that we should do. However, I'm going to leave it to our legal advisor to guide us, you know, in terms of how we could do that.
Interesting, I don't remember. Very attentive. That there is no need, I like to use that, there is no need to go through this suspension phase. The initial remedial action, or the remedial action, doesn't have to be initial, is adequate. Because the directive, as articulated in 37.2, what should be done? Yeah. So, there you are. Terminus.
Thank you, Chair. If I can just catch up for the people, the open drafting papers, will be retaining 37.1 and 2. So the committee is taking a policy decision that we can do away with 37.3, delete 3, and 4. Okay.
Retention of 37.1 and
37.2. Yes, I'm just.
Yes, go for it again.
37.1 and 2 retaining for the people of our vaccine, if that's correct, I want the member to confirm it. That is steps that are up to 37.2, that the minister is giving a directive up to that stage. So from there, the minister, with the empowering the minister, go straight to 7 to dissolve if 37.1 and 2 are not complied with. You want to keep track that is what the committee is directing us to. So we're doing away with the administrative steps in 3, 4, and 5. With the administrative processes in sub 3, 4, and 5.
Can you restructure 3, 5? Yeah, that's what I'm saying, Honorable Doctor. I'm saying, can 5 be restructured? Because at this age in time, it, particularly 5A, it was the indication of 5 was It's just restructuring it. Restructure so that it can fit what we're saying. It's a lot of not. That's why I like the way of our saying that, look, what the stuff that we're coming on now is that, one, the minister decides that, Ismo, I'm giving you a directive, correct yourself. That's the first step. All things be done good. The minister is satisfied. Everything is history.
Yeah.
However, if the minister is not satisfied, it moves to the second step, devolution.
I agree with that.
Yeah, so all it means then, just tweak and restructure fight to fit in.
So what's the problem with fight? Because I don't see any problem with fight.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We're together.
No. I'm hearing that the people want to restructure fight. I need to be clear so that people shouldn't come something tomorrow, then we have endless debate. What's wrong with FAT? Because I don't see anything wrong with FAT. I was saying earlier, FAT is perfectly in your order. FAT is perfectly in your order. Nothing wrong with it. Because they're saying this entity is put under administration. And as a minister, I have a right to review the performance of the administration. So the performance of the city runs still under administration. And I want to say that administration has achieved the objectives that were set for the administration.
Fine.
And therefore, I'm then saying to the administrator, you have done what you are supposed to do, you can leave, I'm bringing the board. So let the people clarify us what's wrong with 5 acres.
No, what two things, Mr. Zanetti?
The DP, also.
DP? Yeah. Oh, sorry, I didn't check.
I can clarify. I think 5 read in isolation is fine, but for me it was confusing if you read it in conjunction with 4A. But if we're going to be removing 4, then 5 is fine.
Remember, on the board. 37.3 and 37.4 are getting out of the way.
No, I
thought
that.
Yeah. Okay. No. I was led to that as well. And then 6, 7, 8. That's okay. Yes, sir.
So the white one that I just want to be sure this matter so that I can understand something.
Okay.
So, you say we are removing 3. So if we are removing 3, then we have to structure 7. Because it says not presenting subsection 3. I'm saying we need to look at, they need to look at that one also.
Yeah. The appointment of the administrator should be catered for somewhere. That will take into take on board.
I was asked if I couldn't allow us to pick up my observations on page 19, if I did. I don't know whether it can be before I...
Okay, sure. I will find people with this. Sure, there isn't anything now. Look, things can be presented to other communities, so, because the general spirit of restructuring or remolding Section 37, we have captured them. Prof.
Chair, thanks for that. I know we're still in page 18, but I just want to highlight something on page 19, the page I did before that. On page 19, I'll start with that small technical one, that is on line 2. Page 19, line 2. Functions as set out, I want to put in terms of the text.
Sorry, Prof. Missy.
It's the second line on page 19.
Mm.
It says function as set out, I'm putting in terms of. Yes, I'm adding in there. I'm taking it now to line 15, 16. Let me take to in line 15 on page 19. Let me start in 15. Seated or assigned to ISMO from another organ state. I'm underlining the organ of state. And I jump, I go to line 26, that I'm going to read the whole paragraph, that is 2A. In 2A it says, any reference to an organ of state in the items register, trademark register, design register, biz register, or any other register, is with effect from a visiting vesting deed contemplated in Section 1C, is deemed to be a reference to ISMO. So there is the organ of state is defined to be deemed the reference to ISMO. I want to assume, therefore, that in that line 16, that organ of state there cannot be the same as ISMO. So if it is not, can we say what it is? Because if we say organ of state and organ of state, it's going to be confusing.
Right. Can you pick that up and run it?
Thanks, sir. I think we would sort out the wording. Probably what was supposed to happen is to try and deal with the referencing differently. I think the idea there was that you would have another organ of state other than ISMO transferring assets to ISMO. And then the reference there on 2A, it then sort of confused that by referring back to ISMO. I think we just need probably, we'll see how we draft it later, you take out that reference to ISMO as an organ of state, then you leave the top one so that you can always refer to other organ of state which are not necessarily ISMO. But I think the drafters will have to look at how they word that. Because the idea is that you need to have other organ of state transferring assets, which we then need to qualify at some point, transferring assets to ISMO rather than ISMO transferring assets to other organ of state.
Thanks, Prof. Let's go back to... Oh, you had your document as well. You know, we're back with the department. We've dealt adequately with Clause 37, now we're in Clause 38.
Thanks, Chair. When I'm looking at it, I think we dealt with 38, and in 38 we dealt with the line, and I don't know, section, trying to find the way of referring to the thing. On the A list, on number, we dealt with number 22, we dealt with number 23, if I'm getting it right. I think we are on clause 39 now, on the A.
Okay.
Clause 39, Chair, it's an inclusion of a consultation clause when the minister do regulation. I'm noting the fact that on our previous meeting or previous committee meeting, there was an agreement that we need to include something there that says the minister must therefore table whatever regulation under this to Parliament for noting, and Parliament, if it doesn't respond within a particular time frame, then the minister could then proceed with that. I'm flagging it because it's not here, but I think it's something that was agreed upon at previous meetings, probably previous meeting. Yeah. I think only the latest version that would be reflected. And then on page 18, the same page, I think that's line 37 now. 37 deals with data, let me just read it the way it is. It's 18 on line 37, after the word ISMO. We are removing the subsidiaries, because remember we've already removed it on the other section. So I think it's probably that we take it out here as well. Then
there is another clause that we are sort of bringing in, that we are sort of substituting on line on page 18 again, from line 39, just below the clause that we sort of removed now. There were comments that says we don't need to draft it the way it's drafted. We don't have to refer back to cabinet and parliament when doing policies. Bear in mind that we have already mentioned the fact that on the above clause that when we minister do the regulations and on this act, we would include the clause that says those regulations must be tabled to parliament. Now, the second clause, now 39.3, it seems to suggest as it stands that even the policies must go to parliament and cabinet. Now the suggestion is that, I'm talking about the clause now that's not there on your A list, the suggestion on the amendment is that on 39 we rather talk about the minister when she does the regulations, she's going to consult, and then before she promulgated the final regulations, she must then bring those regulations to cabinet. But in addition to, she must bring those regulations to cabinet, and then after cabinet, those regulations must come to parliament. Which means we sort of leave the policy part, you know, for not to include it as something that needs to come to parliament. I think that was the suggestion. I would then leave it for members to deliberate on it, its input. So.
Other members, another thing, don't you think we should retain 39.3d? Because if you want that to be done in, under regulations, we should also be doing it here. That's my humble thing. Honorable Lotto.
I think before, I want to clarify before I come to offer my opinions on the matter. Is it a normal practice that before a minister develops a policy that they should take to parliament? Or practice that the minister develops policy and they implement policy? And then the responsibility of parliament is to oversee, to exercise oversight on the implementation of the policy that has been developed by government. I want to say every policy must come to parliament to be ratified. That the way things are done, because I'm not familiar with that.
Thanks, Chair. I think the normal practice is that when the minister do policy, she normally or he normally consult with cabinet in terms of the policy direction. I will make an example, for instance, of the IRP. When the IRP is done, it's sort of, she would in principle go to cabinet and say this is what we want to do, and then cabinet will then endorse that and say you can do this within this framework, and then the minister will then go out and consult within the framework on which she got mandate over, and then she will then amend the policy and based on the input that she would have received from the public. And if the input or if the amendment in accordance with the input doesn't deviate from the initial cabinet approval, then she will then go and accept it and say it's the final approval. But if that deviates from what cabinet approved in principle, then it will have to go back to cabinet to say, look, we went out and consulted and this has been changed. That's why if you look at the proposal, we were sort of proposing that probably we shouldn't have the policies, you know, being tabled to parliament in terms of the proposed amendment. I think it's some of the things that were raised in terms of the during the public hearings, that the policies probably shouldn't be subjected to parliament. But I would leave it.
Okay. Honorable Lotto, Honorable Swain.
I'm just trying to make a follow up on that. I want to establish a normal practice. Correct me here. my understanding is that when Parliament adopts five different positions of government, adopt the budget estimate of national expenditure, they have adopted serious policies because it's contained in there. There's a business plan, there's a budget. The question is why do you want to, the point that I'm coming to, why mainstream do you want to say cabinet, whenever they develop policy, they need to come to Parliament for endorsement of the policy? That was my initial question, because, and hence, I would want to go along with your amendment. Because as it's written here, it means any policy that the minister develops must come to Parliament. And I'm saying I'm not aware of that situation. Because Parliament adopted the budget together with the business plan. The business plan came with a maybe broad phrase around nuclear. I'm giving an example. Broad phrase around nuclear, diversifying the energy mix and that is nuclear. So you are saying every time the minister develops, there are various policies that will flow out of nuclear. So you're saying every time the minister develops a policy on nuclear, then they must come to, I'm saying they must come to Parliament. I find that problematic. So, and hence, I'm saying, I'll support only the instance where we're talking about regulations, that the regulations must come to Parliament. But for any policy, then to come to Parliament to be advised, I think that's a common policy. I'm not familiar with it, I'm not familiar with it. I understand the cabinet process, but not the Parliament.
Honourable
Kelly. Yeah, thank you, Chair. Yeah, I mean, I agree with Honourable Malotta on regulations, and I think that is something which has become almost grounded now in legislation, is to say regulations should come to us. Particularly on a complex bill like this, which is going to be implemented in phase, I think regulations should definitely come back to Parliament to ensure that it's in line with the initial legislation that was passed out. But I'm just looking at the comments from the different public hearings from Busa and Nedlac. I mean, they were quite adamant that the Minister should be obliged to probably consult on regulations and policy before promulgation. And I presume you put Parliament in here because that's the place where public consultation could then take place. Because I'm just wondering how else you've captured this, because you have agreed to those, and I'm wondering how else you've captured that kind of public consultation. Are you saying that Parliament should be the arena of public consultation before these policies and regulations get implemented? I mean, the issue of whether policies should come to us, I think that generally I would agree with Honourable Malotta around policies, for saying that it is very much in the ambit of the executive to derive policies, and that we don't necessarily have a role in that as such. But I think that when we're dealing with such a complex entity, and that it's going to have to be implemented in phases, where policies would have a direct bearing on the functioning of this particular entity, then maybe it isn't a bad idea to have come to us to make sure that in fact it's in line with our initial thinking with regard to the taking up of this. So I don't know, I'm meant to be convinced either way, so I'm going to sit here.
Advocate Nyesi, Kesa.
Thank you, Chair. Let's try to work on gloss and net. Thank you. We'll try to work on clause 9 so that we amended subsection 3 to propose that to take out the policy being taken to Parliament and to read that we're making the amendment or amending the regulations, the minister must bring them to Parliament, must first invite public comments and duly consider the comments before finalizing the regulations. And in sub in B, said the minister must table the regulations in Parliament before publishing the final version in the Gazette. So I'm wondering if that would be said, so we need to add more on that.
No, Chair, I, in view of what Honourable Mulota and Honourable Kreling are saying, I just wanted to bring a legal perspective into their arguments. So Section 44, subsection 4 of the Constitution, enjoins Parliament, when exercising its legislative authority, to do so in terms of the Constitution, to do so consistently or within the confines of the Constitution. The Constitution envisages a separation of powers between between the legislature, the executive and the judiciary. In our role is to oversee the executive and to pass laws in terms of the constitution. These, of course, are the functions that we do perform. The executive's function is to develop and implement policy. Now, around the issue of the development and implementation of policy, our role is not to approve those policies at the legislature. Our role is to oversee that the executive act consistently with those policies. It is only when those policies are now being developed into law that they affect us as the legislature, because they come into the domain of the legislature, which is to make laws. So I would say I would submit with respect that a proposal that says we must approve policies would be inconsistent with the Constitution. I think there's nothing, of course, in practice developing that, but you cannot write into law such an instruction, because that power we're giving ourselves as a legislature will be inconsistent with the Constitution. However, the issue that you need to differentiate between a policy and a regulation. Now, a regulation, remember I said our function amongst others is to make laws. Now, a regulation is lawmaking, but that has been delegated to the executive. Now, it will be delegating irresponsibly if we say develop regulations. We don't even want to see what you're developing. Now we say we're giving you our function, but we are not exercising any control on how you exercise that function. That is why it becomes then critical for the legislature to say, once you have exercised that delegated function, we want to see what you have done, because we will still overrule you because we've got that inherent competence in terms of the Constitution. So I thought, just to differentiate the two between a policy and regulations, why one would necessarily have to come to the legislature for its approval, or perhaps for it just to see it and then comment on. The third issue related to the issue of facilitating public involvement, as suggested by Honorable Freyling, who says, look, perhaps it's not a bad idea to bring it here so that we could conduct public hearings. But again, I mean, why do you want to assume that role when you can, in the legislation, admittedly, because the Constitution does not place that obligation on the executive when so developing policy to consult, but you can, in a piece of legislation, say, where you do so, you must consult. So we can write in this piece of legislation a provision that tells the executive that when they develop this policy, they must consult members of the public. I thought I needed just to make that input, Chair. Thank you.
Quite helpful.
Yeah.
Can we say then, let's look at what is can you highlight it and see how members feel now as it is highlighted, where it is. All of the members also take on it now, as it is restructured in that way. Fine. Okay. So that is it.
Wait a minute.
Okay, thank you.
We are on, I think it's just to go back a bit. I think on the policy part, we're saying we're going to, the minister will develop policy and will consult with members of the public. I think it's just to write that. On 27, 927 on the A list, which is page 8 on the bill, page 18, so on the bill. What we are doing there, we are saying in, from line 43, I think it's 43, when I was sort of counting it, I think I found it's 43, just the end of that section, section 39. We are saying we need to include a section that deals with regulations. I think if you look at the way it was structured, we didn't list the regulations that were sort of emanating out of this legislation. I must say some of these regulations we sort of extracted them from the content of the document for purposes of easy reference, and we listed them there. Then we added a new section, which is section 4, subsection 4, right at the end, section 39. Which reads that the minister may make regulations to ensure the effective implementation of this act, including regulations relating to. I think this clause you will read with that session that Mrs. have already highlighted, that before she does that, she must consult with the members of the party. The criteria to be used by the minister in determining customers to whom ISO may sell electricity, to whom ISO must sell electricity, or whom ISO may purchase electricity directly from generator, including technical criteria, financial criteria, criteria for national importance, or from security or from a security perspective.
Yes, on that. Your document here, the document now. I was checking, if you are referring there to the deadline, who may take the electricity directly from generator? I turn to page 22 of the bill. Page 22 of the bill, paragraph 3.3.1. There you refer to the power from generators and then include the independent power producers, which didn't fit anywhere in the system. But that's wondering which it would not be prudent to include those including independent power producers in this section. So if you get what I'm saying. I'm saying there in 22, your generators included independent power producer. But I say we do not be prudent to put them here to think about that, not really for now. Again, before I run away, say, can I turn to page 4 of the document? I'm over the winner. Page 4 of the document, that's a small one. Your clause 41, 29.11. I'm reading the headline suddenly. He assumed.
Page
4 of this A list content.
Oh, I see.
This is on page 4, clause 41, while in 29, that's 41.1. I'm reading the headline suddenly. He assumed. Do we say N phased or A phased? I'm just changing that N to A phase.
Okay. But I'm sure, Prof, it's the ease of inclusion of IEPs is more appropriate than Matuna. Sure, we'll agree. They have to be distinctly defined. And I will not.
I'm just posing another question. If they are not defined, how do you assume that generators refer to all generators? Whether you are a state-owned generator, like ESCOM, or a private-owned generator, do you need generators sufficient? Say, if you are a generator, you are a generator. inspection over there. Private home or private home. I'm just and let the young man have a sorry.
I think the thinking of that if you refer to a generator, like the doctor said, it's a generator, you know. Doesn't matter whether it's an independent generator or not an independent generator. But when I was looking at it, I was near high school assist as well. When I was looking at it, I was like, you know, anyway, it doesn't harm to mention a specific generator and say, such as, for instance, IPP. But I would be guided with by our advisors, legal advisors, is how they feel about it.
Okay, let's do that for now. Okay, where are we? Regulations and policies. Honourable members, we've made inclusions on changes on the issue of how the minister should make regulations and how the minister should make policy. Are we fine now? Yes. I see you raising your hand and saying yeah.
I'm happy with it, even the provisions of the new subsection 4. Because I think this subsection 4 addresses the concerns about the phasing in of the work of ECO, determining the customers and whatever, the transfer of customers. So through this provision, we could be able to use it for the phasing in of ECO and clarifying certain aspects of it.
Chair, I don't know, perhaps if it's just something that the committee might just want to brainstorm or think about. On page 4 of the regulations that have just been added now, paragraph C. So there he talks about the transfer of assets, comma, rights, comma, obligations and stuff not otherwise dealt with in terms of section 40. The issue of transfer of assets is broad in view of the discussions that unfolded before the committee. With that provision could well be interpreted to include what I don't want to talk about. Transmission of it. So I think, in view of those discussions, I would imagine that you don't want that to happen. And if I'm correct in that, then you would have to exclude them here expressly. Because if you're not doing that, and you don't intend for now to have them transferred, they might be transferred in terms of this provision. Thank you.
Honourable Sadie?
Yeah. I mean, I presume when we talk about assets, it's not just the assets of the grid, and it's also the assets of the computers and all of that that's in there. So, I mean, can we not allow for both of that to be defined in terms of where we are in this whole process? Are you saying that if we put in the assets now, that it indicates that we are going to be talking about the grid also being moved as well? Is that the problem?
Okay, what I'm saying is it's open-ended. Someone might read that same provision to transfer things that you did not intend to have transferred. So I'm saying those that you don't want transferred, you will have to expressly exclude from this provision. That's the point that I make.
Honourable Fading, then Honourable Lott.
I'm reading this from, I mean, it starts from 4, does it not? I mean, it says the Minister may make regulations to ensure the effective implementation of this Act, including regulations relating to the transfer of assets, rights, obligations, and stuff. So, I mean, those regulations would have to come back to us, I presume. So, I mean, if she puts in the regulations that she wants that the generation assets transfer, then clearly that's something that could be taken up at that point. Are you saying we might limit it at this particular juncture?
You, my suggestion is that limit it in the principal act. Because remember, the minister cannot, in the regulations, do something contrary to the principal act. But if you don't specify, you don't expressly exclude it here, then the minister has got a blank check. All he or she needs to do is to fill in the figures. Yes, it is correct that you do have an opening if the regulations come back. But this is what you need to understand, the regulations are not coming for approval. If the regulations lie here for 30 days, and we've done nothing about those regulations, the department is well within its rights to go publish those regulations and they become effective. And you will hear when people complain that this happened, and you ask yourself, how did it happen?
Can we get a motivation from the government why they want to, what they had in mind about talking about assets outside? Because the section is very pushing money is very on the assets. It says, I'm going to read the last part of it. Look at 41A, Roman figure R1, which at the end it says, which can legally be transferred, see there for assigned to this form, in order that it can perform its function out in terms of this act. You know, just to get a motivation from the department, what were they thinking about? Because it's very clear that the assets are for the functioning of Israel. Why do we want to even think about functioning the assets that they are not and stuff that is outside section 41? From the field.
Okay, yes, very much.
Thanks, sir. I think I agree with the sentiment that probably we need to exclude transmission explicitly in the provision regulations. But I think the motivation is that we need to transfer certain assets that are related to the functioning of ISMA. I think that's the whole idea. But I think if some wording is coming out that if we want to transfer assets that are not related to ISMO, I think that's not the right correct wording. The thinking is that we need to transfer assets that are related to the functioning of ISMO. Obviously, if you look at the way ISMO is structured, or if you look at the way system operations and market operations are structured, you may find that there are certain things that are not necessarily sitting within that particular space at a point where you are transferring it. Like, for instance, let's talk about, if you look at the way in which ESCOM they were explaining how the whole thing functions, they would say they don't have, for instance, an HR, you know, division for system operations. They use the same HR for everything. And the thinking of that, probably you would want, or even coming from the flag that probably if you take away system operation, there might be people who are coming from the HR department that might as well go along with that, because I mean those people don't know of no use because the service is more, for instance. I think that's the thinking and the rationale behind the decision.
Yes.
If that's the case, I would agree with advocate to another. Because here, 41, you're asking ESCOM Holdings. We're not asking ESCOM ISMO. We're saying ESCOM Holdings must comply with it. So everything that you have to assist ISMO, whether it's sitting in transmission or sitting in generation, must form part of those assets that must be compiled to go back to what I read. We can legally be transferred, seated or assigned to ISMO in order to perform its function that's set out in terms of this act. So anything that's sitting, whether it's head office or generation, that's relevant to the functions of ISMO, will be transferred. So I think then we would have to get rid of, not otherwise there would be in terms of section C 40, because that would be wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think the same would have to apply to section D and D. Because D here you're talking about the transfer of functions, indeed the timelines within which this most must be execution thereof, not otherwise dealt with in terms of section 41. My concern here, and I would also advocate another to help us here, we have clearly stipulated what are the functions of this. Now, if we are saying we are going to talk about something else here, say the transfer function includes timelines within which this more must assume the execution thereof, not otherwise dealt with in terms of section 41. I haven't gone to section 41, but I'm just concerned without having read section 41 that then the minister might end up developing functions that are not in line with the principal act, that are even beyond the principal act. I haven't read 41, but I'm just saying, if I'm looking at it here, the transfer of functions into partners within which small must assume the condition thereof, not otherwise dealt with in terms of section 41. I haven't gone through section 41. I'm just saying we need to look at it so that we shouldn't have a situation where the minister might end up transferring functions that are not provided for in terms of the act, because it lends it too quickly. 41.5 says the notice to refer to in subsection 4 must provide detailed blend measures for the transfer of such funds in order to ensure continuity of electricity supply. So I'm not sure whether my concerns do hold or are valid.
In light of the discussion around, I think the other thing we'll do to consider all the drafters is whether the issues raised in C and D cannot be sufficiently covered in the transitional provision of the body of the bill. So we need to sit down and discuss all of that.
C and D in C?
In C in, in the list of the regulations. The discussions, Chair, the transfer of assets in paragraph 6.
Okay.
Price and location, and D is the transfer of function. So maybe those things can just be sufficiently investigated in the transitional arrangement.
Okay. There's a one question. Usually, if you look at in the bill itself, page 18, if I'm sorry, take you back there, sorry about that. Line 48. That's 41A, ESCOM holding mask on the effective date. Usually it's said before or on. Wouldn't it be better to say before or on? Sure. Yes, sir.
My follow-up question also would be, would there be any harm if you had just removed, not otherwise dealt with in terms of section 40, which still empowers the minister to make regulations around the transfer of assets, rights, and obligations and stuff, full stop. That still not provide, I'm saying when you are still going to consider that, without removing what's written and proposed under section 4, new subsection 4, and even on the transfer functions, timelines which must assume the execution thereof full stop, and then delete not otherwise there in terms of the section 41. It then still provides the minister with the power to make the regulations, one on the key customers. You know, the debate we had on the issue of key customers, two on the issue of the rights and obligations that are attached to that, and C on the transfer of assets, transfer of functions being D. I'm just saying, if you had to remove that, it is not still provide adequate without deleting it, still because we want the minister to still make regulations in relation to those areas without reaching the C and E, just remove the ones that is expanding beyond the principal.
Thank you, Chair. Also, another valid option we will also consider.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I would not go back and repeat what has been said. From my reading now on clause 40 on the bill, okay, I think Chairperson, we have already made comment on 41, which we would take on board. And the other comment was on page 18, which is 40, on line 48, on the same sentence where you made a comment, we're sort of proposing that we need to omit effective date, say, effective date, and I think how it should
propose. So even my suggestion for the
now,
what you're saying is that it's an equivalent thing. ESCOM holdings must be within the time period determined by minister.
Yes, I think that's the proposal on that. So that's because I think there was some secular reference. Because effective date is the date of operationalization of the bill. So if you use the effective date there, it means like on that day and the asset must be, you know. So you need to check out that and give that flexibility so that it's aligned with the phased-in approach that we have been discussing earlier.
But in practice, it reads the ESCOM holdings must be within the time period.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, fine.
We just need to do our drafting properly, but I think that's what that's how it should read.
Mm.
And then on page, then we move to clause 41 in the bill.
Just on that, sort of curious that if you look at page 19, clause 4, line 41, the transfer, at least 1 month prior to the transfer date, the chief executive officer of ESCOM Holdings must be for any employee of ESCOM Holdings performing functions pertaining to ESCOM to make an election. Do you feel 1 month is adequate for someone to make an election to either move or not to move to ESCOM? I'm just provoking that I just said.
The thinking was that it is sufficient because you would, I think the work of ring fencing the function will start, actually started some time ago. It's not something that it will start when we promulgate the legislation. The thinking was that work, I think, started as we speak. When the legislation comes, you would have already dealt with a lot of those issues. But I think if there's a concern, probably we could make a provision that allows the minister to extend that time frame if necessary. I think that it's possible to do as well. I think the thing was that you need to try and drive it and put the same timeline.
No, that's fine. I mean, it didn't okay in my mind what you're saying, that the awareness is already there. Okay. Just out of interest, page 5, line 55, 6. It's a funny clause, soft clause. Can you just help us out? Pacha comes in again. Let me see. if the question arises whether any person performs. What is this surplus for? What does it mean? Page 19, if you look at page 55, 36, line 55. If for the purpose of section 5, the question arises whether any person performs functions pertaining to Isma, it goes wrong. It's first a question. Such question must subject to. It's a very, very interesting thing. And now that you have raised Padre being a state on the thing, anyone who can have an example of a question?
Yeah,
it doesn't say issue, it says question.
Yeah.
I think that's what attracted my attention. It said question. Not even query or complaint.
Sure. I think let's have a look at, I think the assignments of mood. I'm not good with Paja, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think today our advisors will have a look and see whether what that purpose to mean.
Yeah, in some of the issue whether the what question means, which I think maybe is a query or a doubt, but the application of Padre saying, you know, the what a query or an issue must be decided by the CEO of ESCOM, subject to giving that person an opportunity to be heard or to take reasons to hear the upside of that person's representation. So that is why Padre applies it. Like, the CEO cannot just take that decision without making the proper inquiries in terms of time, before fairness towards the person involved. What type of questions would arise out of another issue to be decided?
Okay, the homework in any case. Okay. Back to you,
Thank you, Chair. I think we are on... Okay.
On 41.
It's cross 41, page 20.
Line 31. Just before you go into that, if you go to line 11 and line 15, reference that means such employee salary and salary scale may not be reduced, and the other one, line 15C, another conditions of employment may not be less favorable. You know, with the English word may means there's flexibility. Now, why should there be flexibility when people are transferred? I'm sorry, my trade union background comes up. I know I'm a member of parliament, but I'm sorry. I need to be fairly clear to that, and we don't want unions to come back screaming at us as well. And also, my understanding was that also transfer would be done in terms of section, what is section 189? Of Labor Relations Act. Yeah, so it's not 197, yeah. Now, does, if I can also just flash another question, does section 197 allow term me. I was expecting must, let me be honest.
Chair, I think it's a drafting issue. I'll allow our advisors to have a look at it. I think it's a drafting issue to the sense that the use of may and shall, you know
may and must.
Yeah.
Our advisors told us shall.
Yeah, they say we should use shall. We should use
May or must.
And I would agree with you probably that we should use must. But I think it's a drafting sign. I don't know whether the state advisor has something to say about
the use of that must. Why, when you transfer people, the issue of making that optional, comes up now?
It's because when we're looking at this section, actually we had a lengthy debate around it with business and labor. Because the thinking was that in any event, this section needs to be driven through the Labor Relations Act. You know, the Labor Relations Act would sort of guide on how the transfer and the conditions and all the likes would go. Hence, there was that flexibility from this side so that you allow the Labor Relations Act to take its course in terms of how the conditions should look like in terms of the transfer. But actually, we even deleted most of some of the sections that were here because it was like you can't legislate that here because the Labor Relations Act already, you know, outline, you know, the framework, you know, to deal with such things. I don't know what I'm talking about.
It's not just a question of drafting or anything. It's like it's a policy decision which is very nice. If it's very nice to make something compulsory, we will give them a must. If we will the drafter, if the developers make something optional, we will give them a may. So it is something which must be answered from the policy perspective. Do we, and then this committee will can just, if you're not getting an answer, can just tell us which we want to make this compulsory. And is it, what is reasonable?
Let's
so
let's
make sense.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I think there are two issues, or two options, at least from where I sit. Because I hear that the department says, yeah, they intend opening the processes in terms of 197 of Labor Relations Act. So why don't then we simply say, amend this provision to refer to the specific section of the Labor Relations Act that deals with these issues.
Okay.
That is one option. The other option is if we are to stay with this provision, my suggestion would be make this obligatory because may make it discretionary.
Mm-hmm.
And I can imagine that labor, organized labor in the Netherlands must have been hard at work with this provision because it gives the employer a discretion to either maintain conditions as they were or make them less favorable. And you can't allow for that type of discretion. I think those are the two options really that I will propose. Thank you.
But even if you look at D as a whole, you know, when I tried to read it about two, three times, I ended up scribbling a question that will ISMO have the same ESCOM funds and or scheme? I can't grapple with it to understand it, but I can see something is being said about ensuring that those who are being transferred, they should have their funds, benefits or rights transferable. That is too lengthy. It was too lengthy for me to understand. I'll allow Honorable Lotto, who are on page 20, but I really would like to hear the department also responding to what Advocate Banab, you know, is suggesting the two rules. Honorable Lotto.
Even if I don't have the rule of what Advocate Banab said, it might be safer to just to state that it will be done in terms of section 197 of the Foundation Act. After all, I know there is a similar case of this matter. The employees will take it to court if you don't deal in terms of section 197, say the transfer, and the provisions of the Labor Relations Act are going to be on 197. But this is similar to 197. So I don't see any harm in just stating that you've done in terms of section 197.
We really would like to anchor the issue of transfer around 197. I think that's the thrust we'd like to see coming out. Because as it is now, you can see it's unfortunately triggering a lot of queries which down the line have a risk of having comebacks, you know, and challenges. And even people might even say that these two pieces of law are in conflict with each other. One is discretionary, probably the other one, I do not know, just guessing, maybe obligatory. Can you conclude together that? Can you restructure it such that it actually makes reference to 197 more than being expressive as it is here? Because I assume that all of these things are contained one way or another, both in the primary and the secondary legislation in the Labour Relations Act. Yeah, so it's the practice now which may even make that law to be refined time and again. Okay. Back to you, the Minister.
Thanks, sir. I agree. I think what we need to do probably should take out from A to E, and on section or subsection 9, which say when employees of ESCOM becomes employees of ISMO, or we just need to wait that. Maybe we need to pick our word to refer back to the fact that when you transfer employees from ESCOM to ISMO, we must do that in terms of the Labour Relations Act. Then we sort of leave it at that. We don't try and paraphrase what the Labour Relations Act should or is saying around those issues. I think that's my proposal, that we just take out from A to E and we sort of just reweight 9 to flag that.
For interest's sake, let me just for interest's sake, without delaying it, to read you what 197 says, transfer of contract of employment, you go to, I'm just putting things to be. It says if your business is transferred into the process, investing in the adoption chain, 1B, unless about the contract of one thing that is existing, immediately before the old employers were in the out of situation, transfers, don't have the new car, but all the rights and application between the old and old employer and each employee at the time of the transfer remains rather than application between the old employer and each employer. But I'm just saying, those are the provisions of the 197.
No, it doesn't allow this discretionary arrangement. I want to get a little bit weaker. This is what I was getting of, it doesn't allow for discretion. Okay, let's agree you'll restructure it accordingly. Okay, you can move on now.
Thanks, sir. We move to clause 41 of the bill, which is page 20 from line 31. So I think it's line 31, not from line 31. Which is 41.1. I think at the end of that section we are sort of adding provided that the execution thereof by ISMO may be assumed in then introduced Prof's comment there in a phased manner as determined by the Minister in a note in the Gazette. We are sort of trying to continue to emphasize the fact that the functions of ISMO would be transferred from ESCOM to ISMO in a phased manner. I think that's what that section is sort of trying to emphasize. And then on clause, same clause 41, and then on page 20, on line 33, we substitute 42 with the following clause. Actually, what we have done there, we sort of added at the end of that line, of that clause, as parties may agree. If I were to read the whole clause, what it says now, 41.2, it will say, ISMO must enter into contractual arrangement with ESCOM for the execution of its function, I don't know whether that's the right way of writing it, contemplated in section 4, as parties may agree. We sort of added as parties may agree in that sentence. Then on page 20,
yeah, you have to give down of such a function so that people with good proficiency in language.
Yeah, they would have to look at that. I don't think it's correct. Yeah, I don't think
okay.
it's right. And then on page 20, on line 37, to substitute clause 41.4 with the minister in consultation with cabinet determined by notice in the gazette the date for transferring of the function to ISMO referred to in subsection 2. I think what we are adding the you know referred to in the function referred to okay so the date for transferring of the function to ISMO referred to in subsection 2. We're sort of just adding that to try and qualify what that function, who those functions relate to. Thanks, Chair. I think that's all.
I think we have checked our cards enough today. What we then expect the department and the advisors to take on board all what we have you know responded to, and I think am I correct now that you can then confidently come out with an aid clear a list which we'll consider on Tuesday the 19th. Can you do your best that and you share it with us so that we can at least sleep on it on Monday night so that we can more productively handle it on Tuesday. On that basis, I thank honourable members for their contribution and being with us up now. The meeting stands adjourned and let's meet again on Tuesday. Okay. Thanks very much.